Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to begin by talking about something that may strike you as quite boring, although it's an integral part of your life, and it is the grocery business. But this is an unusual article in that this is the merger of two major players in the grocery business. The article is from Bloomberg Businessweek. The title of the article is In Context, a Supermarket Antitrust Replay, by Leah Nylon. When supermarket operator Albertsons & Company took over rival Safeway in 2015, it won government approval to complete the $9.2 billion deal by agreeing to a remedy antitrust regulators had been allowing for decades, selling off some stores in overlapping markets, a move that was supposed to maintain competition and help keep shoppers' grocery bills down. That divestiture of 168 supermarkets was then the biggest ever. It was also a disaster. Many investors in the sold-off stores lost their shirts, workers lost their jobs, and communities lost vital access to fresh food and low prices. Only half of those stores survive today, as Albertsons' competitors, a Bloomberg analysis found, and some were bought back by the large chain for as little as $1 after their ailing buyer foundered. Almost a decade later, that scenario may be playing out again. Kroger & Company, with about 2,800 stores across 35 states, agreed in October 2022 to acquire Albertsons, which owns 2,200 stores in 34 states and the District of Columbia, for $24.6 billion. The companies are proposing to sell off nearly 600 stores to keep regulators happy. But this time, government officials are pushing back. In an antitrust case filed by the Federal Trade Commission and nine states and territories that will go to trial in August, regulators contend that the 2015 Albertsons-Safeway debacle showed that major divestments don't work in the food store business, and that this latest supermarket mega-marriage should be prohibited. Skepticism of the Albertsons-Kroger deal is strongly supported by what happened in the Albertsons-Safeway merger, where stores closed, jobs were lost, consumers suffered, and the divestiture failed miserably to preserve competition, Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser says. We won't risk such another failed divestiture. The stakes are high, not just for shareholders of the two companies, but also for the towns and shoppers that could suddenly find themselves without a convenient grocery store. Just ask Tina McKim, a co-founder of the Birchwood Food Desert Fighters, which distributes food weekly to about 90 families around Bellingham, Washington. The Birchwood neighborhood saw its local Albertsons grocery store close after the earlier merger. Residents, many of whom don't own cars, were left without a close, reasonably priced outlet for food and staples. Instead, they had to take lengthy bus rides to other markets or shop at expensive convenience stores. It's really been a struggle for people in the neighborhood, says McKim, who worries that the proposed Albertsons-Kroger tie-up could leave other towns in a similar situation. We want people to be able to access food with dignity. In the 2015 deal, Bellington-based Hagen Holdings bought most of the stores Albertsons sold off. Within months, Hagen declared bankruptcy and was gobbled up by Albertsons. The result, Albertsons ended up buying back 44 of its former stores along with the 14 groceries the Hagen chain had originally operated. 10 other locations closed permanently, and 17 more were converted to hardware stores, gyms, and even a hotel. That cautionary tale, which FTC Chair Lina Khan once called a spectacular failure, is now a key piece of evidence in the agency's case, which heads to trial on August 26th in Portland, Oregon. Kroger and Albertsons say their deal will benefit consumers, bringing them more modern stores. It will also bolster the grocer's clout with suppliers to push food prices lower. The increased buying power and cost sharing will help them compete with bigger retailers such as Walmart Incorporated and Amazon.com Incorporated. The merging companies have offered to sell 579 stores to C&S Wholesale Grocers, the largest U.S. wholesaler food supplier, which is affiliated with the Piggly Wiggly chain. It operates only 23 supermarkets in New York and Wisconsin and has little retail experience on the West Coast, where many of the supermarkets to be divested are located. The merging grocers say C&S is better financed to make the stores successful and shouldn't be compared with Hagen. But in three separate lawsuits to block the merger, the U.S. and state attorneys general pointed to Hagen as proof that the large store divestitures risk failure. The Albertsons-Kroger proposal to sell markets to C&S, they allege, is just history repeating itself, this time with even bigger stakes. Hagen, once the largest independent grocery store in the Pacific Northwest, was sold in 2011 to the private equity firm Comvest Group Incorporated, which closed underperforming stores until only 14 groceries and one pharmacy remained. After Albertsons announced the Safeway merger in 2014, Comvest saw an opportunity when the supermarkets proposed selling off almost 200 stores in areas where they directly competed. Hagen originally wanted to bid on only 22 stores, but when the firm backing Albertsons, Cerberus Capital Management LP, wanted most stores to go to a single buyer, it agreed to purchase 146 supermarkets for $309 million, including locations in Arizona, California, and Nevada, where it had no existing business. In February 2015, the FTC cleared the sale. Within 6 months, Hagen filed for bankruptcy. This was how the merger played out in Bellingham. After buying Hagen out of bankruptcy, Albertson closed its store in the Birchwood neighborhood, which serves a racially diverse, low-income community, and the nearby Lummi Reservation. The city couldn't coax another grocer to the location because Albertsons maintained a restrictive covenant on the building that prohibited a rival leasing the space until 2038. A Big Lots store opened there in 2019, but it sells only dry goods such as cereal and canned soups. A local Mexican restaurant offers some produce and dairy products, but it can't accept food stamps. In late June, Albertsons agreed to lift the restriction on the building's use after Bloomberg Businessweek submitted questions about it and the Washington Attorney General's office began an investigation into the practice. Now, locals worry what impact the pending supermarket megadeal might have on their town. Kroger and Albertsons are the two largest chains in Washington, with over 300 supermarkets collectively, more than half of all grocery stores in the state. So, disruptions could follow. This next article has absolutely nothing to do with groceries, and it begins with a test. If you can answer this question, we will award you thousands of extra credit points. Here's the question. What well-known religious group has recently begun to adopt the use of electric bicycles? The answer is the Amish. The article is Amish communities are trading the horse and buggy for e-bikes. And the article is from Forbes magazine. Long viewed as tech-averse, the Amish have become enthusiastic users of electric bicycles, so much so that one Ohio community has become a testing ground for new models. For decades, driving the two-lane country roads that ran through Holmes County, Ohio's leafy green hills, meant sharing the road with small black horse-drawn buggies, iconic transportation for the area's Amish community, the second largest in the world. But today, as you pass through fields tilled by horse-drawn plows, dairies, and sawmills, something else might grab your attention. Hordes of locals dressed in the plain 19th century fashions favored by the Amish, whizzing by on electric bicycles. Typically thought to be tech-averse, eschewing cars, computers, smartphones, Amish communities are increasingly making an exception for electric bikes and the solar panels and battery that keep them powered up. Though it's a rural region, Ohio's Amish County in the eastern portion of the Buckeye State has become a bigger, more mature market for e-bikes, which retail for between $1,500 and $2,000 than cities like Cleveland, Columbus, and even New York. We've sold in the range of 10,000 e-bikes over the last 10 years in Holmes County. Jesse Lapine, co-founder and COO of Magnum, the top brand in the area, told Forbes, "The adoption rate there is so much higher. People, even 6 or 8 years ago, were much more likely to know about, own, and ride e-bikes in Holmes County, Ohio, than they were in Manhattan." Lapine said the company sells thousands of bikes a year through Amish distributors in the community, and the market there is so enthusiastic it's become a testing ground for new models. Magnum's not alone in targeting Holmes County's Amish. It's the wild success of the e-bike in that community, says Levi Conlow, co-founder and CEO of Lectric E-Bikes, whose Lectric XP3O was likely the top-selling model in the U.S. last year. While the Phoenix-based company doesn't directly market to the Amish, it promotes its e-bikes by sponsoring the Mennonite Mom, a YouTube influencer who posts videos about her farm family that adheres to related religious views. Salt Lake City-based Magnum is also mindful of local preferences. Nobody wants a bright, shiny bike that sticks out. So black, low-step commuter bikes ended up being the bike there, he said. And on a recent summer afternoon, hundreds of those bikes buzzed through the streets of Berlin and Millersburg, tourist hubs packed with shops selling wooden furniture, crafts, cheese, and baked goods from Amish artisans, said Beholt, home to the Amish and Mennonite Heritage Center, and a sprawling 360-degree painting by a German folk artist depicting centuries of their history. Horses and buggies still make their rounds, so hitching posts remain as common as bike racks. Some riders, particularly older ones, wear traditional straw hats and bonnets, but many younger ones have helmets and bright reflective safety vests over their muted gray or blue dresses and long-sleeve shirts and suspenders. E-bike sales aren't tracked as closely as cars and trucks, though they've grown rapidly in recent years. In 2022, U.S. electric bike ownership hit a record 1.1 million units, 4 times the volume sold in 2019, according to an Energy Department report from late last year. Globally, the e-bike market was likely worth $44.9 billion last year and could hit $77.6 billion by the end of 2028, according to an estimate by BCC Research. As an aside, it isn't that large a market in the United States, but imagine, if you will, the number of electric bike riders in China. Back to the article. The surging popularity of this very modern form of transportation in Amish communities has been building for at least a decade, according to Lapine and David Mullett, founder of E-Bikes of Home County, the region's biggest retailer and a member of an old order Amish church. While e-bikes can be found in communities in northern Indiana and the Lancaster, Pennsylvania region, home to the largest Amish population, Holmes County hilly geography makes them particularly appealing to people who need to commute to work. They come in with the working Amish who work maybe 5 to 10 miles away from their home, in a woodworking shop or wherever, said David Klein, a retired dairy farmer and writer, who's also a bishop of an old order church near Mount Hope, Ohio, that permits its members to use e-bikes. The owners of those businesses bought e-bikes for their employees because it was a lot more cost-efficient than hiring somebody to pick them up in a car. That's sort of how they slipped in the back door before we were aware of it. Over a century ago, as the Ford Model T became the first mass-market automobile, most Amish decided personal car ownership was not for them. It's a no-no. It disturbs Jemende, Klein said, using the word for community that's central to Amish religious beliefs. We're fairly open to technology. We use modern medicine. We go to the dentist. We donate blood. The car was really the first piece of technology that the Amish said, whoa, what will it do to the community? And as we know, Henry Ford's Model T destroyed thousands of small communities. Though e-bikes allow riders to travel greater distance at higher speeds than buggies or traditional bikes, they aren't generally as disruptive to the community as cars, he said. They really picked up with working people as an easier way to get to their jobs. But this time of year, you've got the whole family going on them. Little guys, big guys, mama with a trailer behind, and maybe there's a baby in the trailer, said Klein. And all the major roads around here have buggy lanes, which are also perfect for bike lanes. The most Amish county is Holmes County. It was first settled by the Amish in the early 19th century, and they account for almost 45% of its population. It's the most Amish county in the country, says Joseph Donnermeyer, a professor emeritus at Ohio State University, who studied Amish communities for decades. Though they don't embrace many types of modern conveniences and typically aren't connected to utility grids, landline telephones, or the internet, the Amish are not anti-technology. Views on what's acceptable are gradually changing, with an eye towards upholding religious tenets that emphasize a need for some separation from non-Amish communities, said Donnermeyer, citing 2 Corinthians 6:14 as a foundational biblical passage for Anabaptist religious groups, which include the Amish, the Mennonites, and the Hutterites. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? What it boils down to is they interpret the symbolism of that. So we can have a solar panel that charges a battery that runs an electric bike, but we're not connected to the electric grid, he said. The Amish concern over technology, it's not technology per se, but its effect on the community. While electric bikes recharged by the sun are acceptable to a majority of the Holmes County Amish community, the same wouldn't be true of a solar-powered car if one existed, according to Klein. No, the car lets people travel too far, and in an enclosed environment with a heater and air conditioning, which allows you to ignore weather conditions. With a bike, you're very subject to the weather. It also has a more limited range, he said. Once you have a car, there are no boundaries. Long before the e-bike boom, Amish in Holmes County were also early adopters of solar and battery systems, and the region likely has the highest rate of residential solar power generation in Ohio, according to Donnermeyer and Jacob Hirschberger, founder of Trail Battery and Solar in Millersburg, an Amish businessman who sold the systems to his neighbors for more than a decade. It started about 20 years ago, Hirschberger said. About 9 of every 10 homes have something anywhere from 3 to 15 to 18 solar panels. An average installation is about a 4-kilowatt system. Battery systems are normally up to 10 kilowatt hours. The Amish use far less electricity than the average American home. So in addition to charging e-bikes, solar and battery systems help power things like household lighting, small appliances, and water pumps, according to Hirschberg. We're probably more green than anybody. During Ohio's months of gray autumn and winter skies, locals augment their solar system with small generators, Hirschberg said. Still, Holmes County is something of an anomaly among Amish communities, as e-bikes aren't yet as prevalent in other North American communities. In Lancaster County, with a very large Amish population, very few Amish ride bikes, says Steve Nolt, a professor of history and Anabaptist studies at Elizabeth College in the heart of Pennsylvania's Amish region. At one point, 10 or 15 years ago, I could safely have said that none of the Amish here rode bikes, even just the pedal variety. That's not true anymore. Some do, But riding bicycles here has always been one of these symbolic separators. Traditional bicycles are generally popular in northern Indiana, home to another of the large number of Amish churches and communities, said Nolte. But e-bike sales in that region don't rival those of Home County, according to Magnum's Lapine. It's not just the sales Amish e-bikers use their bikes so heavily, with some racking up thousands of miles a year. That Holmes County is a key test market for Magnum. They're kind of ground zero for us to test. We hear from our community of riders there about how our bikes stand up when we release new products or new technology, new batteries, Lapine said. They tell us whether we need to increase power or consider different components. They're excellent partners of ours and the bike dealers there because they give such valuable feedback. There's no hard data, but locals and researchers like Donna Meyer estimate that e-bikes are now accepted by about two-thirds of local Amish churches, each of which decides the rules for its members. But more conservative sects, such as the Schwarzentruber Amish and Andy Weaver Amish, are among those that don't. Even among Old Order Amish, the largest group, traditionals like Mart Miller remain strongly opposed to battery-powered bicycles. My biggest concern is they're exchanging the Amish mode of travel for higher-speed transportation that will eventually lead to the car, said Miller, a retired farmer and bishop of an Old Order Amish church near Mount Hope, Ohio. We have a lot of people out there where the parents do not own a horse and buggy anymore, so the children will not learn how to use a horse and buggy. The introduction of cyclist safety gear that comes with e-bikes is also a concern. It brings along a totally different lifestyle, he said. The dress mode is different, and I don't blame them, but a hard bike helmet and all the clothes they wear, they are totally not respectful to the way Old Order Amish should dress. And that is just the way it is. Now we're going to do another article on a topic that you will hear from time to time on the program. The title of the article is In View Common Ground, Universal Basic Income, Exploring Two Sides of a Contentious Issue and Finding an Elegant Compromise by Sarah Holder. This is from Bloomberg Businessweek. Part 1, The Predicament. The idea is radical in its simplicity. Give people regular cash payments to help them meet basic needs with no strings attached. It's a quick, albeit costly, way to fill gaps in the social safety net. And it's the premise behind universal basic income, more commonly known as UBI. Since 2018, more than 150 pilot programs have launched across 35 U.S. states, targeting specific populations, such as new mothers or youth transitioning out of foster care. Over the span of months or years, groups are getting regular payments of about $500 to $1,000 a month, funded by public and philanthropic dollars to do with as they wish. Opponents of guaranteed income are becoming more vocal, saying such programs eat into funds that would be better used on food or housing aid, and even run afoul of state constitutions. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton sued Harris County in April to halt its pilot program, and at least nine states have proposed or passed legislation that would preempt localities from starting their own. Is there a way for polarized policymakers to find rare common ground? And now the case for universal income. Unlike food stamps or housing vouchers, unconditional cash can just as easily be spent on gas and groceries as on emergency car repair. Although research shows recipients typically use the money for essentials, the flexibility is the point, advocates say. Guaranteed income allows people to juggle multiple issues at the same time, says Mary Bogle, a principal research associate at the Washington, D.C.-based Urban Institute. Studies have shown the effects of even short-term income boosts can be profound, especially when delivered to parents. Getting cash aid early in life has been linked to better test scores and higher incomes as adults. Here's the case against. The most obvious case against a truly universal basic income is that it would be prohibitively expensive. Critics argue that to free up money for such a benefit, governments would have to cut other social spending. Others see even targeted programs as another form of welfare that discourages people from working. Workforce participation shrinks, and that's bad for communities. It's bad for small businesses. It's bad for the economy, said Haley Holick, a senior fellow at the Foundation for Government Accountability. Here's a potential area of common ground. In the United States, there's growing bipartisan consensus around one variant of basic income targeted at parents, a universal credit that benefits young children who can't control their circumstances, has broad appeal, according to Josh McCabe, director of social policy at the Niskanen Center, a nonpartisan think tank. During the pandemic, the existing federal child tax credit was temporarily expanded and paid out monthly for all but the wealthiest families. Congress now is debating a bill that would help more low-income families get a bigger credit. If it passed, it could lift around 400,000 kids above the poverty line in the first year, estimates the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. States are meanwhile providing their own case studies. 15 of them, red, blue, and purple, administer their own child tax credits, and most have no minimum income requirements. And now we're going to talk about digital money and how it works. This is from Bloomberg Businessweek. The article is by Teresa Z. If you have a burning question about how money actually works, Patrick McKenzie probably has the answer. The software blogger vaccine database founder's widely read newsletter, Bits About Money, is dedicated to thinking about the often misunderstood concepts at the intersection of tech and finance, or as he puts it, the modern financial infrastructure that the world sits atop of. McKenzie started his career as a salaryman in Japan, working 19-hour days before quitting to work for himself. Now he advises payment processor Stripe Incorporated, in addition to software and writing work. His real passion, though, seems to be making sense of what happens when you tap pay on your phone. Our conversation with him has been edited for clarity and length. What's the difference between a bank and a digital wallet on my telephone? In the mists of prehistory, there was essentially one place to hold money. It was an account at a bank, and all your ways to access the money were mediated by that bank. Life has become much more complicated with a plethora of apps that present different things on your phone, but that to the user feel like very similar experiences. Tap, 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 my money moves. But under the hood, there are complicated legal and technical substrates that are different from each other. What's the most misunderstood thing about financial transactions? People broadly assume their money is sitting in a vault somewhere and that it's something that they own. But their money is usually a debt by some other party in the economy to them. That confusion between money as an asset and money as a debt, and how money is sometimes simultaneously an asset and a debt, drives a lot of the confusion about how non-specialists, about how the financial ecosystem works. What are the consequences of people assuming their money is just sitting in a vault somewhere? I think it informs a lot of discourse about the banking sector. People in both broader society and financial technology circles are critical of the banking sector, particularly after 2008. It's not that banks have never done any wrong, but if you assume they're simply supposed to be guardians that count up the money going in and out of your vault, you would, one, assume they're getting paid exorbitantly for doing this, and two, ask why we'd have to keep bailing them out. We're going to take just a moment for a station break now, folks. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. Now back to the article. The answer is that they're not simply vault guardians. They're doing a fairly complex form of alchemy to turn large portions of the economy into money, into this thing we can access at will on our phones and buy on our cards. Are there big differences between sports gambling sites like FanDuel and stock trading sites like Robinhood? I think innovation in financial technology is largely pro-social. I think it was a true fact that many banks in the United States, for a variety of structure and technical reasons, did not really invest in giving users beautiful, easy-to-use affordances for accessing their own money. And I think that's rapidly improved over the past 10 years. However, not everything you can put in a beautiful application and design on top of is actually in the customer's interests. Robinhood is a gambling app that wears the clothes of a responsible financial institution. It was abundantly obvious from the way they used to talk about the product. It was abundantly obvious from their advertising campaign. And it's abundantly obvious from reading their quarterly and annual reports and seeing how their bread is actually buttered, where, for example, a large portion of revenue is due to options trades, which retail consumers, and particularly the retail consumers Robinhood attracts, should not be making. In a statement to Bloomberg, Robinhood chief brokerage officer Steve Quirk said that any comparison between Robinhood and gambling apps is a complete mischaracterization, and that the app is designed to help users make informed investment decisions. When you buy something online, you have all these card and payment options in front of you when you check out. Why are there so many different ways to pay? That number is going to increase over time. For a very long time in the U.S., there were 2.5 logos. It was Visa, MasterCard, and then maybe Amex. We're going to see more logos because facilitating commerce is fundamentally a very valuable business to be in. And increasingly, over the last couple of years, businesses that did not construe themselves to be truly in the financial industry have discovered that if you have a business which is well-loved by consumers, that facilitating their ability to make payments to you and others is just an excellent, excellent business to be in. Historically, only the largest companies in capitalism could afford to do this. Apple and Google, most famously, discovered that they have this wonderful piece of glass and plastic that people have in their hands every day for large portions of the day, and that if they put payments into that piece of glass and plastic, then that both of them causes them to have a direct revenue line associated with payments and causes the user to transact more of their economic life onto the service of the tech company controls. So even if Apple and Google were able to charge zero for transactions, they would prefer those transactions occur over the internet on devices they controlled, connected to their advertising ecosystems, versus having these transactions occur off the internet. That logic applies to the largest firms in capitalism. But because the scale you need to launch a new payment method and to get it accepted by various places has been decreasing over time, that on the margins brings more firms to this business. Now we're going to do some articles on the state of the economy, which may have changed. For those of you that follow the Dow Jones, you will have noticed over the past several days, it has dropped over 2,000 points in a major sell-off after a bad jobs report for the month of July. So rather than sticking a soft landing, it now looks as though we may be seeing just the beginning of a recession. There are many opinions about this in the media. I'm going to read you three, but remember one thing. This program is being recorded on August 6th. You will hear it on August 12th. This is a very fluid situation. Things may have changed in the course of a week. At any rate, the first article is, "The U.S. economy has defied recession forecasts for years. Is this time different?" It's by Max Zahn. It's from Forbes magazine. A worldwide sell-off jolted markets on Monday in the aftermath of a weaker-than-expected U.S. jobs report that elicited fear of an economic recession. Japan's main Nikkei 225 stock index dropped more than 12%, its worst day of trading since 1987. Each of the major U.S. stock indices plummeted more than 2%. NVIDIA, a chip maker that helped catapult market gains so far this year, dropped as much as 14% before recovering some of these losses. Renewed warnings of an imminent recession arrive after years of doomsday forecasts that stretch back to the staggering rise of inflation 3 years ago. So far, the U.S. has defied alarm and sustained solid growth, proving many analysts wrong. Economists who spoke to ABC News disagreed about whether current economic conditions warrant serious concern about a possible recession, or foretell resilience of the kind that has followed previous bouts of uncertainty. Some analysts voiced optimism, pointing to continued economic growth and a tendency for markets to overreact in the face of negative news. Others cautioned of a month-long labor market cool-down that indicated wider economic weakness and a potential downturn. You can see the probability of a recession moving slightly higher, but for me, it's nowhere near the level at which you jump out of the window because the house is burning. Olu Sonola, the head of U.S. regional economics at Fitch Ratings, told ABC News, "You can still safely take the elevator or go down the stairs." The stock market downswing was set off by a disappointing jobs report on Friday. Employees hired 114,000 workers in July, falling well short of the economists' expectations of 185,000 jobs. The unemployment rate climbed to 4.3%, the highest level since 11/21. The unemployment rate has soared this year from 3.7% to 4.3%. That trend has triggered a recession indicator known as the SOM rule, which says that a rise of 0.5 percentage points in the unemployment rate within a 12-month period typically precedes a recession. Some economists have doubted whether the true trend signals a recession in this case. That's because the rising unemployment rate owes more to an increase in eligible workers that has expanded the labor pool rather than layoffs that have reduced the number of people with jobs. The labor market is still growing, and the unemployment rate remains at a historically low level. "I still think we're in the soft landing stage," Stephen Weiler, a professor of economics at Colorado State University and a former Fed research officer, told ABC News, "predicting an outcome in which inflation returns to normal and the economy averts a recession. Some people expected this recession 2 years ago or more, and it still hasn't come about," Weiler added. Some economists rebutted that rosy outlook, however. Nancy Lazar, chief global economist at investment firm Piper Sandler, said the uptick in the unemployment rate marks a key piece of evidence, indicating a recession will take place before the end of the year. "It wasn't just a one-month number," Lazar said, referring to the jobs report on Friday. "This has been a rising trend." The recent labor market cool-down took hold roughly 2 years ago, after the Federal Reserve began raising interest rates in March 2022 as part of an effort to dial back inflation. "On average," Lazar said, "the economy dips into recession 2.5 years after the Fed begins a series of rate hikes." "We've been expecting a recession to unfold," Lazar added, acknowledging that Piper Sandler had previously forecasted a recession as early as the end of 2023. The firm had erred in part because it underestimated the staying power of pandemic-era government stimulus, she said. "We are now at the highest risk of the economy moving into a recession," she added. On Sunday, Goldman Sachs economists raised the probability of a U.S. recession in the next year from 15% to 25%. The market downturn has triggered calls for a large interest rate cut at the Fed's next meeting in September. Some investors have voiced an even more urgent request for a rare emergency rate cut as soon as this week. In theory, interest rate cuts would ease borrowing fees, unleash consumer demand and business investment, and help the economy avert a downturn. Economists, however, said an interest rate cut likely would not help the economy avoid an imminent recession, since rate changes typically affect the economy only after a period of several months. Pointing to the market drop-off on Monday, economists said investors have a track record of overreacting to emerging trends in the economy. But experts added, market swings can help bring about a recession anyway. Markets always tend to overreact to the upside and overreact to the downside, said Sinola, adding that market sentiment may in turn weigh on business investment and economic activity. It can be a self-reinforcing feedback loop. The next article is explanatory about a term we used in the previous article. The title of the article is, Everyone is Talking About the SOM Recession Indicator. Here's what you need to know. It's by Sam Meredith. Global stock markets are in the grip of a deepening rout, prompting investors to turn to one of the most time-tested indicators to determine whether the U.S. economy is in a recession. The so-called SOM rule has observed without fail that the initial phase of a recession has started when the three-month moving average of the U.S. unemployment rate is at least 0.5% higher than the 12-month low. The rule's inventor, however, is not convinced. We are not in a recession now, contrary to the historical signal from the SOM rule. But the momentum is in that direction, SOM told CNBC by Mayo on Friday. A recession is not inevitable, and there is substantial scope to reduce interest rates. SOM previously worked at the U.S. Federal Reserve and is now chief economist at New Century Advisors. Expanding on her view, SOM cited U.S. consumer spending, production data, and household income as reasons to be cautioned about the inevitability of a recession. We're in a place where things have slowed, so we're not in contraction territory. That, frankly, is not good enough. We can do better than avoiding a recession, SOM told CNBC's The Exchange. People have started to use the SOM rule to define whether the U.S. is in a recession. Dario Perkins, managing director of global macro at T.S. Lombard, said in a research note published Monday, While this is nice to know, better than waiting for the National Bureau of Economics Research, it misses the point, Perkins said. The SOM rule is trying to tell us something deeper about the recessionary process. The proper insight is that if the jobless rate rises by 0.5%, it will probably rise a lot more. It's about reflexivity, he added. Policymakers at the U.S. Central Bank on Wednesday held interest rates steady, although Fed Chair Jerome Powell gave investors some hope by signaling a September rate cut is on the table. SOM said a recent batch of weak economic data had called into question the Fed's decision to hold off on cutting interest rates until next month. They don't need to all at once, but we do have that lever to pull and take some pressure off the economy. This economy is in a good place. It just needs some pressure taken off it, she added. In mid-June, SOM told CNBC that the U.S. Central Bank risked tipping the economy into contraction by not cutting interest rates sooner. Asked on Friday whether there was evidence to suggest that questionable market signals had complicated the picture for the Fed's decision-making process, SOM replied, We can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. In terms of macro forecasting, macroeconomic policy, investing, I mean, this is really hard. We never have all the data. We always want the next data release. We always want that better piece of information. And so any decision that the Fed is going to make, they're going to have to make it under uncertainty, SOM said. Our understanding of what is happening right now is so very challenged, and what that means is, and I'll be the first to say it, as someone who has a rule attached to her name, don't just rely on one tool. You've really got to open them up and think hard about where they disagree most. Now, for our final article on the state of the U.S. economy, we're going to talk about the Fed and the possibility of an emergency rate cut. The article is entitled, Why the Fed Almost Certainly Isn't Going to Do an Emergency Rate Cut. Stocks closed deeply in the red for a second day in a row on Monday, as questions swirl over whether the U.S. economy is in a recession following Friday's unexpectedly weak job reports. Investors are increasingly hopeful that we'll push the Fed Reserve officials to come to their rescue with an emergency rate cut. That almost certainly won't happen. There's nothing in the Fed's mandate about making sure the stock market is comfortable, Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee said in a New York Times interview on Monday. In hindsight, there's a strong case to be made for why the central bank should have cut its benchmark's leading rate at the meeting last week, which concluded before the jobs report came out. Had officials known the unemployment rate was going to jump from 4.1% in June to 4.3% in July, almost a full percentage point higher than where it was at the start of the year, perhaps they would have been more convinced that the U.S. economy is weakening enough that the benefits of a cut outweigh the risks. But calling an unscheduled meeting now to lower rates ahead of the central bank's next scheduled meeting, that's more than 6 weeks away, would be counterproductive, fueling more panic. The Fed's rate-setting committee meets 8 times a year to vote on where officials believe interest rates should be to promote maximum employment and stable prices. But if something comes up in between those meetings that changes their views on the ideal level for rates, officials can gather for an unscheduled emergency meeting. The last time they did so was at the onset of the pandemic, where they voted to lower rates by a half point on March 3rd. Then, less than 2 weeks after that, they met again to lower rates by a full point to near zero levels. At that point, the writing was on the wall. Things were getting ugly quickly. By doing 2 large emergency cuts in succession, Fed officials didn't have to weigh whether their actions would unnecessarily cause Americans to panic. Before those cuts, the last time the Fed was promoted to do an emergency rate cut was in the thick of the Great Recession, shortly after Lehman Brothers collapsed in the fall of 2008. The last thing the Fed wants is for people to believe the U.S. economy is on the cusp of a potential recession. Those beliefs can quickly materialize, whether or not they're valid. As a general proposition, I do not like intermeeting cuts. I think they signal more panic than they do stability, Charles Plosser, then president of the Philadelphia Fed, said at the central bank's emergency meeting held October 7, 2008. But he said he was reluctantly comfortable with an emergency cut since other central banks were doing it. That is not the case currently. Central banks that have cut rates recently, including the Bank of Canada, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of England, have done so at pre-scheduled meetings. So, if the Fed were to move forward with an emergency cut, people would inevitably wonder, what does the central bank, representing the largest economy in the world, know that everyone else doesn't? That's exactly what then-San Francisco President Janet Yellen expressed at an unscheduled meeting the Fed held on January 9, 2008. I'm concerned that it might be taken as a sign of panic by the committee and somehow wrongly indicate that we have inside information showing that things are even worse than markets already think, Yellen, who is now Treasury Secretary, said to a Fed transcript of the meeting. She was also worried about an emergency cut could be seen as an overreaction to the employment report, referring to December 2007's job report that came out 5 days before the Fed met. The report showed the nation's unemployment rate jumped by 0.3% to 5%. Ultimately, officials waited until another unscheduled meeting weeks later to lower the rate. At the October 2008 meeting, Plosser cautioned that cutting rates immediately wouldn't make the next couple of months in terms of the overall economy any less painful. That's the case today, too. To a certain extent, It won't matter in the intermediate term what size cut Fed officials settle on and the timing of it, because it can take roughly a year for any interest rate moves to be felt throughout the economy. And already, U.S. Treasury yields are sliding a lot in anticipation of rate cuts. Since they serve as a bellwether for the interest rates Americans pay on a range of loans, the dip may help ease the financial burden facing borrowers currently. Our next article is from CNN News, and it concerns an antitrust development for Google. The title of the article is, Google Loses Massive Antitrust Lawsuit Over Its Search Dominance. Google has violated U.S. antitrust law with its search business. A federal judge ruled on Monday, handing the tech giant a staggering court defeat with the potential to reshape how millions of Americans get information online and to upend decades of dominance. After having carefully considered and weighed the witness testimony and evidence, the court reaches the following conclusion. Google is a monopolist, and it has acted as one to maintain its monopoly. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta wrote in Monday's opinion, it has violated Section 2 of the Sherman Act. The decision by the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia is a stunning rebuke of Google's oldest and most important business. The company has spent tens of billions of dollars on exclusive contracts to secure a dominant position as the world's default search provider on smartphones and web browsers. Those contracts have given it the scale to block out would-be rivals, such as Microsoft's Bing and DuckDuckGo, the U.S. government alleged in a historic antitrust lawsuit filed during the Trump administration. Now, said Mehta, that powerful position has led to anti-competitive behavior that must be stopped. Specifically, Google's exclusive deals with Apple and other key players in the mobile ecosystem were anti-competitive, Mehta said. Google has also charged high prices in search advertising that reflect its monopoly power in search, he said. Those contracts have long meant that when users want to find information, Google is generally the easiest and quickest platform to go to, which in turn has fueled Google's massive online advertising business. While the court did not find that Google has a monopoly in search ads, the broader strokes of the opinion represent the first major decision in a string of U.S. government-led competition lawsuits targeting big tech. This case in particular has been described as the biggest tech antitrust case since the U.S. government antitrust showdown with Microsoft at the turn of the millennium. Neither Google nor the Department of Justice immediately responded to a request for comment. The case is distinct from a separate antitrust suit brought by the Biden administration against Google in 2023 related to the company's advertising technology business. That case is expected to head to trial in early September. But Monday's decision marks the second high-profile antitrust defeat for Google after a federal jury in California said in December that Google runs an illegal monopoly with its proprietary App Store. The court in that case is still deliberating possible remedies. Mehta's decision is expected to trigger a separate proceeding to determine what penalties Google will face, and the company is also likely to file an appeal. But the ruling could ultimately upend how Google makes its search engine available to users by impacting its ability to make the pricey deals with device makers and online service providers that were the heart of the case. If the court takes away Google's agreements that make it the default search engine on so many devices, it could hurt the company's core product at an extremely pivotal moment, eMarketer senior analyst Evelyn Mitchell-Wolf said in an emailed statement. Its ubiquity is its biggest strength, especially as competition heats up among AI-powered search alternatives, Mitchell-Wolf said, referring to the growing threat to Google's search dominance posed by artificial intelligence search tools such as OpenAI's ChatGPT. At the time the lawsuit was first filed, U.S. antitrust officials also did not rule out the possibility of a Google breakup, warning that Google's behavior could threaten future innovation or the rise of a Google successor. The ruling could also be a bellwether for other major tech antitrust cases that are moving through the courts, including against Apple and Amazon. Both Amazon and Apple have called the antitrust lawsuits filed against them wrong on the facts and the law. We're going to close with an article on Taco Bell and why this fast food chain is performing well, as opposed to the performance of McDonald's and Starbucks. The title of the article is, Taco Bell Could Hold the Secret Formula for Bringing Customers Back to Fast Food. Fast food giant Yum Brands is going all in on value, but only Taco Bell is performing well enough to immediately bring back inflation-weary customers. Temporary store closings in the Middle East, Malaysia, and Indonesia due to the Israeli-Hamas war, in addition to a more cost-conscious consumer, have presented headwinds to same-store sales, CEO David Gibbs said in a second-quarter earnings call on Tuesday. But Gibbs said Taco Bell is outperforming its rivals in the fast food industry. I think we're really seeing Taco Bell stand out from the crowd, he said to investors. Customers are looking for ways to stretch their dollars, something McDonald's and Chipotle learned the hard way. Gibbs lauded Taco Bell's 10-item value menu as a prime example of a way to bring in those price-weary customers in a challenging environment. They're unique items that nobody else in the country has, and they're not like junior-sized versions of the core item. They're unique, Gibbs said. Yum has launched or reintroduced value deals at all of the biggest names in its portfolio. There's KFC's Taste of KFC deals and Pizza Hut's $7 deal lovers. Taco Bell, known for its cheap eats, has an extensive cravings menu. Since the platform launch, Taco Bell's chicken sales mix has increased 10 points, with nearly 1 in 4 orders including a chicken cantina items, Gibbs said. That's all we have time for today, folks. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11.